I'd like now to introduce filmmaker Phil Grabsky. His documentaries include In Search of Mozart, In Search of Beethoven, In Search of Haydn, and Leonardo Live. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
So how did you start making the In Search of films? Were you responding to or maybe even making up for some of the things that were missing in the existing films on great composers?
It's a slightly more strange genesis than that, actually. I had been making a film in Afghanistan, and my family said, for the next project, could you do something a bit nearer home? And my wife took me to see a Mozart opera. And frankly, during those 3 hours, I started asking lots of questions to myself about just who was he? How could this opera house still be full? You know, with tickets costing whatever, $150 each, and it was still full. Where did his creativity come from? I mean, I'd seen Amadeus as a kid, and loved it as a film, but you know, I knew it was a Hollywood film, and albeit shot in Prague. But I have the advantage, I suppose, that I film things myself. So I thought, well, I'll go and find the best historians, the best musicians, the best orchestras, and ask them. And I'll go to as many of the places that he lived and traveled and played and performed in and get a sense of his life and try and piece it all together. I didn't realize quite how hard that would be, but I absolutely loved the journey. But that's why it's called In Search Of, because it was a genuine search on my part. I didn't write the script and then go and try to fill in, the visual gaps. I went off genuinely searching to find the real Mozart, if you like.
Well, one of the amazing things about these films is the access you got to scholars and conductors and musicians and orchestras, and not only access, but they're speaking to you in such a natural way as if you were long friends with them. How did you do that?
Do you know, it's when I look back at the films now and I see the cast list, I mean, I was very lucky. Part of it is that, traditionally these kind of films are made for television where it takes you about 5 years to get a commission and then they want it in 3 months because they've suddenly realized there's an anniversary coming. That's not the best way to make films. The best way to make films is take your time. It takes time to gain the trust of Emmanuel Axe or Daniel Barenboim or whoever it might be. And then you have to coincide. These are not well-funded projects, or at least, it's hard to raise the money for them. So you can't really pay these musicians great deal, and in fact, what could you pay them? So you have to ask them to do you a favor, and generally speaking, they'll say, look, we like your project, we're happy for you to film, but you need to coincide when we're actually performing that particular piece in a concert. That could be 12 months away. So on the one hand, you have to be patient and prepared when you actually go to film. I think the second part of your question about the way in which they behave on camera, I've made films about, Muhammad Ali and Pele and great commanders. And so, worked in all sorts of spheres, military, sporting, soccer. I don't think I've ever met such genuinely nice people as in the world of classical music. There's some theories why that might be. But I think that what I found is that, first of all, I'm turning up on my own. So there's not a whole big crew laying cables and making their lives complicated. And then they've waited around for an hour. Then you say, come on in, act natural. I can start filming relatively quickly, and then I'm engaging in a genuine conversation. I'm genuinely interested in what they have to say. They are, I think, to be a great musician, you have to be, on their part, genuinely passionate about the work, about what they do. And also, I often knew more about the biography in some ways than they did, so they were asking me questions. And, I'm filming. So I'm kind of filming this genuine conversation. That said, I was forever impressed by the articulacy of, Renée Fleming. I remember going to the Paris Opera to film her, and she talked to me for about an hour and 10 minutes, and every single answer I could have used in the film.
Right.
Leif Ove Andsnes, a Norwegian pianist, another one. I mean, so many of them. The real challenge for me was editing down what they'd said. They were very articulate. And of course, where it's best is when they actually talk about a particular piece and then play a little piece on the piano and say, look, you can see how this is different to how somebody else would have played it. But it is a long process, but it's a rewarding one.
I love those moments. They seem, maybe some people would think that they were didactic, but you learn so much just in these little moments where they play something on the piano the way Mozart wrote it when he was 7 years old and how somebody else would have written it. And they're so insightful. And meanwhile, the way you're filming it, I mean, there's a lot of real close-ups on the musicians' hands and on their instruments and on the vibrating strings of the stringed instruments and on the faces. And it really feels, I mean, it's the films themselves are, I guess, your work of art, the way you're doing it.
Well, I mean, in some sense, that's very kind of you, but I mean, in some senses, I'm trying to be absent. I'm trying to put you, the viewer, the audience, to give you a sense of the privileged position that I'm in by being right next to them. I've been so fortunate to be right in the middle of some of the world's greatest orchestras, and I'm trying to share that. Now, sometimes, of course, you need the wide shot from the back of the hall up in the circle, but really what you don't get to see too much is be standing next to the conductor, be standing next to the first violinist, or some of these great cellists or soloists, other instruments. And that's why also the interviewees look straight at the camera. Again, they're having a conversation with you. Yeah. Because people shouldn't be afraid of classical music. I mean, even today, I mean, I've just flown into the United States, and in my taxi, I don't think he even realized, but his mobile phone was a few notes of Beethoven. I mean, these composers, in my opinion, are examples of what we as mankind are capable of, you know, the great creative achievements. I've just finished a film about Manet, the artist, and he's the same. And I think, you know, it's worth an hour and a half, 2 hours of your time to really get a sense of somebody like Mozart, somebody like Beethoven. Their music is so extraordinary, and it can be just as powerful to an 18-year-old as an 80-year-old. No matter who you are, this is a fascinating life story. What makes Mozart even more interesting, of course, is that many of us got our information from the film Amadeus, which is full of inaccuracies. And that, in fact, Mozart's life is actually more interesting than the story that Amadeus puts forward. Beethoven is slightly different in the sense that most people think Beethoven was, you know, old and miserable, and you know, and a lot of that comes from one late portrait of this kind of slightly fierce, grumpy-looking, white-haired man. That, again, only tells a very, very small part of the story. You know, he was very young, very handsome, full of love, full of optimism. And ultimately, what this is all about is that you can listen to their music and appreciate it, but actually, if you understand the biography, understand the period, why they're writing these pieces, who's paying for them, and what the historical context is, the importance of Napoleon to Beethoven, for example, I actually think it makes the music even more exciting, even more impactful.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, I mean, when you watch these films, I had such a vivid sense watching them of the trajectory of these artists' lives, and you go chronologically, which is wonderful for the viewer, and it seems that their lives were so difficult, and no matter how talented somebody is, then or now probably, they don't necessarily get the rewards or the recognitions until after they're gone, unless they're really good business people.
Well, that was one of the real eye-openers for me, actually. I hadn't realized at all how important commerce and business was for these guys. Mozart basically never wrote a piece of music unless he was paid for it, unless it was a commission, unless he was told to by his employer. We imagine these composers kind of alone in their loft, and they've got their piano, and they're getting messages from God, and it's kind of spewing out of them like a computer. It really wasn't like that. They are business people. Mozart, some of his most famous piano concertos, he's hired the hall, he's selling the tickets, he's employing beautiful girls that he finds on the street to go and sell the tickets, and then he thinks, you know, I need to have a piece of music to play. And the audiences in those times didn't want to hear something they'd heard before. It always had to be a new piece, almost always performed by the composer themselves. So he has to write, in a very short period of time, something that we now think of as one of the greatest piano concerti ever. Other pieces he's writing because he's making his money as a piano teacher. I'm currently making a film about Chopin. Chopin, half of Chopin's life, he's a piano teacher. And it's only really in the summers when he goes south of Paris that he writes some of the, you know, the famous pieces that we now know. I found that whole kind of economic context very important to understanding them, as it still is. I mean, I spend half my life dealing in contracts and sales and just trying to, you know, raise some funds to make these films. It's very, very hard. And the other area, which is, I think, applies to whoever you are, is having that sheer single-minded determination to be the very best that you can be. None of them wanted to be, you know, it wasn't that they wanted to be rich and famous or win lots of awards or be given medals. What they wanted was to be respected as a great composer, as a great performer. But almost more than that was to just to see how far they could go with their talent. And that means that, you know, when they turned up after long journeys in Mannheim or Augsburg or Prague or Vienna, they didn't go and have dinner and go to bed. They went out straight away. First night, they'd go to a concert hall. They'd go to an opera house. They'd listen. They'd make notes. They'd go backstage. They'd talk to the singer. They'd ask all of them, Haydn, Mozart, Chopin, Beethoven, were like that. And as I said, you know, now I'm doing artists like Manet and Vermeer. They're the same. It's about exploring, you know, pushing their abilities as far as they possibly could. And that's fantastic for us now to kind of share in and try to convey in a film.
We're talking to filmmaker Philip Grabsky. One of the things that you just said I find very interesting, which is that everybody who heard them wanted to hear something new. This was before recorded music. We love hearing the same things over and over again.
Yeah.
It's odd.
It's very different. Again, it just helps to contextualize what's happening here. It's a very different environment. First of all, it's just about at the beginning of publishing of music. Now, that's it. That's important to understand. I mean, Beethoven's first published piece is a trio for three instruments, obviously. Now, why is that? Well, because there's a growing demand in middle class, if you like, or slightly more wealthy homes to have written down music so people can play at home. There's no television at home. There's no iPods and all the rest of it, recorded music, as you say, radio. None of that exists. So what people did at home, if they could afford to, was they played music. Well, it tended to be solo music or duets, trios, quartets. So then they need music to perform. So that creates a demand. Therefore, you find Beethoven, Chopin, people like this, writing music for 1, 2, 3, 4 instruments. So the publishing is starting to grow. And that's, you know, that has an impact on the way that they do things. Similarly, if Mozart or Beethoven received, I mean, the famous Ninth Symphony for Beethoven was a commission from London. In fact, he was commissioned to write two, the ninth and the tenth, but he never got to the tenth. So all those things, I mean, concerts themselves were different. I mean, we imagine some of these symphonies, which we now know of as being three or four coherent movements. Well, a concert in those days, you might play the first movement, then a singer might come on, then there might be a piano concerto, then they might play the second movement. People were talking, people were eating chicken, you know, people were making a noise. And again, there are some. I can think of specifically in Beethoven's case, in Haydn's case, where they would write music deliberately to shut the audience up. There's one famous moment in Haydn where he goes very, very quiet, and he makes a really loud noise, where in that case he was worried that people needed to be, you know, woken up if they were dozing. Beethoven does something different where he starts a symphony really, really quietly, so the audience have to stop talking to hear that the orchestra has started. So it was a very different world that these composers were working in. And most of the time, they had to be there, as I say. But again, it starts to change in this period. What is really the classical music period, where all of a sudden, because of publishing, then you have Haydn's music being played in London, Mozart's music being played in Paris. That's starting to happen. By and large, though, these pieces were not heard very often at all, and certainly there was nothing recorded. I mean, if you didn't go to a concert hall to hear them or a fancy house, you wouldn't have heard it at all.
Right, right. Now, let's talk about Leonardo Live, the other film that's going to be shown here in Santa Fe. And it was originally made on the occasion of the 2011 Leonardo da Vinci exhibition at the National Gallery in London. It's a very different kind of film than the music films. Tell us about the process of making this documentary.
I think it comes out, I mean, it developed out of the In Search of films. On the one hand, that desire on my part to explore great creativity and share that with an audience that I know are interested, because I know how enthusiastic the audience are when they see these films. It also came out of the fact that I could see that people liked going to the cinema to see classical music, and I thought, and I was making art shows for television, and I thought, you know what, some of these art shows deserve to be in the cinema. Partly that these days, you know, television doesn't really fulfill its, what I would call its public service moral obligation to bring art to people, but also it's actually better in the cinema, frankly.
Right.
And these days, the quality of the screens is such, the quality of the projectors is such, you know, it's a fantastic place to see art. Now, what we did, first of all, was we did, I was lucky, I got access, well, I know the National Gallery in London, and I went to them, told them I wanted to do a film about an exhibition for the cinema, and they said, well, you're in luck, because we're about to do one on Leonardo. There had never been as many Leonardos in one building. It'll never happen again. It took us 2 years to kind of build up to it, just getting the rights, getting the access, deciding how we were going to film it, getting the guests who were going to talk about the paintings. I worked with a fantastic distribution company who also do the Met Opera and the International Theatre Live shows, and they were, you know, fully supportive of this. So back in November 2011 in the UK, we did a live show from the National Gallery, which was the exhibition, background films about the paintings, background films about Leonardo. There was a presenter, there was actually two presenters and some expert guests. And then that was shown a couple of months later worldwide and actually reached 1,000 cinemas. It was a global first and, you know, phenomenally exciting. But, you know, that was really the trial. And so what we've now started is a brand called Exhibition. And we've launched it with three films. The first film is going to be Manet on April the 11th. And then after that comes Munch and Vermeer. And then there'll be hopefully three or four or five of these a year. And I think, again, it's just that even if you lived in London, you couldn't get a ticket to the Leonardo exhibition. Even if you live in London now, you can't get into the Manet exhibition. So 99.9% of the world's population cannot get to these exhibitions. Just as when I was a kid, I didn't live in London, and we didn't go to these exhibitions. And they are such fantastic works of art that I feel anyone should and certainly could be interested in, you know, with the kind of guide, the kind of person you'd like to be with if you were going around the gallery. So Leonardo, you know, it's a fantastic opportunity to see some of the greatest paintings ever painted on a big screen and hear people explain who he was and what these paintings are. And as I say, moving forwards, I mean, it's not something I'm showing this week because the international premiere is April the 11th, but moving forwards, we're going to do more of these with Manet being the first.
As I was watching it, I was almost desperate to hear each speaker talk at more length and in more depth about Leonardo and their impressions. I guess it's a shorter format, and it's more like a live, I mean, it's called Leonardo Live, and it was at the time a live format, which is so different from the composer films.
Well, I think that's very perceptive of you, actually, and it's something that I'm sure will come up in the question and answer session that I do after the film. I think when we did it in November 2011, there was a sense, I mean, that one was funded by television. They're not now funded by television, but television basically said, we want it live. We want a live program on the day the exhibition opens. And that was exciting to do, but there are slight compromises by doing it live. I think one of them is that, you know, you spend a lot of time getting wonderful guests, but there's a bit of a temptation on a live show to not let them speak enough. One or two might find it slightly overwhelming, suddenly being live, thinking that there might be 1,000 cinemas in 20 countries. you know, I think there's an awful lot in Leonardo to really admire. I think it's a fantastic, you know, I'm proud of the film. But I think this kind of, you know, coincides with your thought, you know, moving forwards, we're not doing it live. You know, the Manet film is not a live film. We still filmed on the opening night. We got exclusive access. But we spent more time with guests. We allowed, you know, we could craft and edit in the same way as I do with the In Search Ofs. You know, I might do a three-hour interview, a two-hour interview. I'm only going to use 3 or 4 minutes. But it means you can use the very best bits and really craft it into the film.
Exactly.
I mean, I think that something like the Met Opera and NT National Theatre, they're fantastic being live because there's that sense of being present at the show, and it's very exciting, and I love going to them myself. I think for exhibition, we need that extra 4 or 6 weeks to really edit and craft and make sure that our filming of the paintings is absolutely perfect and in sync with what's been said about them. And so I think, you know, Leonardo is still worth watching because, you know, you're never going to see those kind of paintings in that kind of detail. And that includes a painting that no one had ever seen before. Salvatore Mundi had only just been agreed that it was a Leonardo. And that's on screen for the first time in that film.
Exactly. Yeah, I saw that film on public television. Now, I wanted to ask you just a little question. Leonardo obviously has the stature of Mozart or Beethoven for visual art, and he was also a musician. And in the beginning of the film, there's a quotation from Leonardo that says something about how art is greater than music because it's not ephemeral like music. Did you put that in to amuse the people who have seen your films about composers?
No, I don't think so. It's a very interesting discussion. I mean, I remember reading a book by Simon Rattle where he says that every night when he performs, even if he's performing the same symphony, it's a new work of art. Whereas if you do a film, but if you do a painting, it is in a sense a fixed work of art. So I guess I was just getting people. I mean, people need to go to the cinema to be entertained. And then if you can educate them at the same time, so much the better. So you need to provoke people to start, you know, to be thinking, to be open to thinking about things rather than sitting back passively. Television, by and large, tends to just want to passively entertain. I think in the cinema, one can entertain and educate a little bit more, perhaps. So I think that's probably why I put that particular quote in. Maybe I was being a bit mischievous. To be honest, I can't remember.
We're talking to filmmaker Philip Grabsky. Now, having filmed, Leonardo and Mozart and Beethoven and Haydn, made all these documentaries about each one of these, what, if anything, besides the fact that we call them geniuses today, do these figures have in common with one another?
Well, the things that struck me were the sheer hard work that goes into reaching that kind of position. And you see this mirrored today if you're a sportsman, if you're an Olympic runner, for example, or you're a baseball player, it doesn't matter what it is. If you're a journalist, if you have aspirations to be at the top of your field, you have to put an enormous amount of time into it. And maybe that's something that maybe a younger generation these days don't quite get. You know, we think that Mozart was somehow some kind of freak because he could play music and compose at such a young age. Well, he had something which is indefinable, of course, but he had a father who was one of the best teachers and violin players in Europe. Basically, all he did as a kid was learn music. He went on tour. He was taken on tour by his father, not as some kind of performing monkey, but so that he could see other musicians, see other venues, learn other languages. I mean, he had this 3.5-year tour as a child, which was really all about his musical education. And then they went to Italy to continue it. So part of it is that what they shared was they just focused entirely on being fantastic composers, fantastic musicians. I think also what was so impressive to me was, again, this whole thing about the context is absolutely essential for understanding. You know, who were their employers? Who were commissioning them? What else was happening? What was happening with Napoleon or happening with the Austro-Hungarian Empire? All those things are actually very significant. I think always luck plays a part. There are moments where these guys are just lucky. If you see the Beethoven film, you'll see a moment when Beethoven was extremely lucky because of Napoleon, and things could have been very different. So, you know, I take, you know, in a very small way, and, you know, I don't compare to these guys in any sense, but I take that kind of dedication to craft and passion about what one does in a creative field. You know, I think that is a lesson that we can still look to. I think it's also true to say that at the end of the day, there's something that you can't quite put your, you know, another individual with exactly the same upbringing and circumstances might not have been able to write the music in the way that they did. So there's always that little bit of mystery. But, I mean, these individuals are absolutely staggering. Even now when I watch the films, and I actually like watching them again, I'm still staggered by the music. If you think that Mozart and Beethoven wrote hundreds of pieces, which are still, as we speak, being played on the radio, played in concert halls, it's absolutely incredible.
Philip Grabsky is a filmmaker. His films In Search of Mozart and In Search of Beethoven and Leonardo Live are screening over the next few days at The Screen on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Not at all. I can't wait to be there in a few days. My first time to Santa Fe. I'm very much looking forward to it.